This is the Pomp and Pony Podcast, powered by Bowser Chevrolet. Here's Bob Pompieni from KDKA-TV and Andrew Filippone from 93.7 The Fan.
Honored to have with us a member of the Retiree Club right now, and after 6 decades of work with the Pittsburgh Pirates in a whole bunch of different capacities, Steve Blass joins us and interrupts his golf game, which I'm sure is 7 days a week now that he's in retirement. And Steve, we're sorry, you might be on the back nine somewhere, so I don't want to, you know, mess up the flow of your game.
Hole.
Maybe the 19th hole. That could be it, too.
Well, that's coming up shortly. It's been a busy day because I've had a chance to talk to a lot of people, and it's a wonderful thing, this 50th anniversary. I'm going to get a chance to see, you know, the guys that are still with us in this world. The only bad thing about this gathering is that our stories will be filled with errors now that we're in the internet part of the universe. So the stats that we used to have won't hold up with the scrutiny.
Steve, when you guys get together, when you 71 guys get together, can you give us a kind of a inside glimpse on what it's like?
Yeah, it's a reunion. You know, first of all, you're catching up. Hey, what are you doing? Are you still doing any kind of work? You retired, and then you check in with the family. How's the family and grandkids and all that sort of thing? And then usually with the miracle of alcohol, then we start talking about our careers and the 71 season. And it gets to be fun, and you know, we're telling stories on each other, and it winds up being a good old time to see some guys who went through a wonderful experience with a World Series year. And that being said, you know, what kind of came to my mind this morning when I was thinking about this whole thing is the fact that the group of minor leaguers that came through our system in the late 60s and kind of meshed in with the guys that were left over, like the Mazeroskis and Stargells and Clementis, couldn't have been a better fit, because in my mind, we had the best or close to the best farm system in all of baseball. When you think about the Olivers and Robertsons and Hebners and Sanguians and Kleins and Keesons and Ellis and all that stuff. So I think the timing couldn't have been perfect for that group to kind of meld in. And I think we wound up in 1971 with a roster of guys that were so not interchangeable, but so well fit that if you took out Oliver, then out of center field, Kleins, you didn't lose much. With the guys, if Sanguin didn't catch or get a day off, Milt May, who would have been able to catch as a regular on any other team. So the mix was good. If you had to make a substitution on one of your regulars, you didn't lose a lot of talent. And I think that we could see that coming in the late 60s, and then in the 70s season, we got in the playoffs, and it just really kind of all came together in 71.
And your performances were one for the ages there. I'm just curious about your favorite memory about some of those games. You don't see complete games anymore in baseball, let alone, you know, when you're talking about World Series. What stood out to you about the way you pitched and how big those games were, and what you felt like when you were on the mound?
Well, they were huge, Bob, because the Orioles had won 16 in a row when you think about their regular season, then sweeping their playoffs. And then winning the first two against us, this is a quality team. 100 wins, they're defending world champions. If we go down 3-0, it's hard to imagine coming back. So game three was the game of my life, and we had to have that game. We just had to have that game because, again, you're not gonna beat them 4 games in a row. And then we wind up sweeping them by outpitching them in the 3 home games. My game, and then the first night game when Bruce Keeson was unbelievable coming in the first inning and 6-plus innings of relief in that first World Series night game, and then Bryles pitching a two-hitter. So, I mean, we ran the table with our pitchers against those 4 20-game winners in those 3 games, and that was absolutely huge. But one step backward, if I can take a minute, the playoffs – were not good for me. I got my face ripped off, and I realized why. I had not ever been in postseason before, and therefore I thought I had to be better. I had to be faster, And I fell into that trap of not being the pitcher that kind of got me there. And so I was able to figure that out between the playoffs. And I had to wait till the third game because of what had happened in the playoffs. So, you know, it just all it fell into place in game three. And I'm in one of those bubbles they talk about where you're just not hoping to make good pitches and throw well. You're expecting to. And it's, you know, I wound up being three pitches ahead of myself. If I'm trying to get Boog Powell set up for a slow curveball, and I'm showing him two sliders first and a fastball, and then I get to the pitch I want. So it just got to the point in that third game where I was doing everything I wanted to. And when I think back on it, that was, to me, that was the critical game. We had to have that game. And then in my mind, okay, I've had my moment in the sun. I never knew anybody that rooted harder for us to win game six because I had had my moment. I was okay with that. But Murtaugh told me if we went to a seventh game that I was going to be the pitcher. So when Frank Robinson slid under Sanguin for the Orioles to win game six, he literally, I was sitting next to him, he tapped me on the shoulder and said, "Tag, you're it." And I said, "Oh, my God." But it's stuff you dream about. You know, when you win game three and your father jumps out of the stands to be with you on national television with Tony Kubek. And then you win game seven as a teammate of Clemente, so he hits a home run. I have a great game. There's a wonderful picture I have in my office of him and I, you know, bare chested, smiling, big smiles on our face after that game. So fantasies and dreams can come true because that October I lived them. I lived all those kind of dreams.
Steve, what was your game plan when it came to Frank Robinson in that series?
Try to keep the ball away from his power because in game three, I gave up three hits, but the one hit that he got was a monster home run because I hung a slider. And so I wanted to move him off the plate if I could and maybe show him an old slop drop that I used a lot against Boog Powell to set up a slider because when I was pitching well, I could throw the slider wherever I wanted to. I missed in game three and it crushed it. So going in again seven, I said, I just got to keep the ball away from him. And as ironic as it was, I struck him out with a slow curve earlier in game seven. But when he got up in the bottom of the ninth inning with one out, Sanghi called for a slider, and I threw it, and it was the exact same slider that he crushed in game three on the first pitch of the at-bat, and he popped it straight up in the air to Jackie Hernandez. Unbelievable. You know, you ever have those dreams where everything slows down? That ball left my hand, and I said, "Oh my God!" He pops it up, but that's baseball. And then the base hit that Rettenman didn't get bounced off the side of the mound, and Jackie Hernandez was able to get it. And I thought when it went by me, I said, "Here comes Jesse," which would have been the right thing. But Jackie was playing shaded up and back of second base, and I turned around. I said, "Oh my God, catch it. Now throw it." And I turned around to Robertson and I said, "Now you catch it." Now all hell breaks loose. So I've got that. My God, I can live that to this minute.
Well, those are some great memories, and all be on display this weekend when these guys get together and celebrate what was a magical year. Steve, I want to also talk to you about just what's happened with pitching since, you know, you've covered, you've done it. We saw Cole not too long ago go 129 pitches and beg to be out there, but we don't see that very often. Why do we not see complete games anymore?
I wish I could answer that question because we were trained that the more you pitch, the stronger your arm gets. And I don't know if it's economics. It's hard to justify that it's for health reasons because there's more pitchers on the DL now than there ever has been. So I wish I had an answer, but I know the more we threw, the more we built our arms up, and it was a different era. And we were trained as minor leaguers to pitch a lot of innings. I mean, when I graduated from high school, I weighed 160 pounds when I signed with the Pirates, and I pitched a little bit that summer. But the next year, 61, I threw like 180 innings as a 19-year-old.
Wow!
And it was just the way it was. I mean, Bob Gibson had 28 complete games out of 37 starts one year. So I don't know the answer, but it breaks my heart when I see, you know, five innings or 100 pitches or something that happened in last year's World Series when Snell got taken out after one hit, I came out of my chair.
You weren't alone.
my goodness. So that has changed. This thing about a runner on second base in extra innings, because I pitched in extra innings, and I was still out there. I'm working hard. I got a tie ball game, and they're going to give a guy two bases to lead off the inning. It's personal. I don't want to get into it deeply, but it breaks my heart to see some of the directions the pitching has gone into.
Steve, I talked to Greg Brown the other day, and he referenced you along these lines. He said, I guess he references this all the time on the air and off the air, that one of the things you believe with baseball is we need to stop making so many damn. I think he said damn. He might even put a word ahead of that I can't even say on this podcast, that we need to stop making so many changes to baseball. Let baseball just be baseball. Is Greg quoting right with that?
Absolutely. I've said for years, even before a lot of this stuff happens, it breaks my heart when we chase other forms of entertainment, and meaning sports. My thinking is that if you leave it alone, it's a grand old game, and if people want to go to this new contemporary stuff or current stuff, eventually they'll come back, because baseball is such a good game. I don't think you have to you can have one traditional game that people just love, and I don't know if I'm right about it, but it's such a good game, I think people will always come back. Even if they go in different directions, they'll come back to the joy of a game, because I think it's an imperfect game played by imperfect people, and that's part of the reasons that we're drawn to it. So, yeah, Greg has quoted me accurately.
Well, it brings us to where we are now, too, with the fact that a lot of we're getting close to the trade deadline, and the Pirates are trying to stock up on things. And I'm just wondering, you've seen a lot of these pitchers, even when, final year where you were broadcasting. Is there anyone in the organization right now that you think can step up and be somebody they could kind of use as core for the days moving forward? Or do they have to do what they're doing, which is just stockpiling a whole bunch of people and, hoping that some of them just develop?
Well, there's always been an aspect of that, is stocking your cupboard, in the minor leagues and hoping somebody breaks through. I'll go back personally for a minute. We had to beg the Pirates to sign me when I came out from Connecticut to try out in 1960. They had no idea that I was going to be a productive pitcher. If you have an 18-year-old young man, I really don't think you can guarantee what you're going to know when he's 23. So, scouting is a big part, player development. I think right now they're trying to do that. They're trying to get as many young kids and make, stockpile the minor league system as best they can. Because, as I said before, in the late 60s, with a stocked minor league system, we walked ourselves into a great decade in the 70s. So, and it gets down to, I hope they can do it. I have a lot of people that ask me all the time, what's wrong with the Pirates? Why don't they spend money? And I don't have the answers. I'd like to see them spend more money, but it's not absolutely that simple. I get down to the fact I'm 80 years old, and I tell people, I say, I live in Pittsburgh. It's my hometown team, and I root for them. And I don't know how to run a baseball business. I got my fingers crossed that at some point they can get it figured out.
Steve, what do you like about the team now?
Well, you got to like some young players like Hayes and Reynolds and Frazier. Now, can you use that as a core to build around? Again, I don't know, and I leave that up to the people that are going to be working on that. Jacob Stallings has evolved into a really good catcher. I didn't know if that would happen, but I think I've been impressed with his improvement. But you've got to have a starting rotation I think you could depend on. We always used to say, you got five starters, I want three I can depend on that are going to be the guys we can count on. So you work toward that end, and they're working on it. It's not happening on a regular basis right now, but I'm still hooked on them.
They just did the draft. They took a catcher over a guy who many believe is going to be like an elite pitcher in Jack Leiter. I'm sure you knew his family, Al, and his brother.
Well, again, I'm not in on those discussions. A dependable big time catcher is so valuable. I remember we missed on Wieters from Baltimore.
Yeah,
yeah.
I thought we were going to have him, and that's a foundation guy. You know, and so I can see them leaning toward that. He's a guy that can play every day. A pitcher ideally can pitch once every 5 days. So you weigh those things back and forth. That's all part of the factoring in. So if you get a good catcher that you can depend on for 10 years, you've made one heck of a good draft. So I'm hoping he can evolve into the guy.
Pony, I'd be curious to hear Steve's take on two words, spider tack.
You're breaking up, Bob.
Come on now. I know people. I've talked to pitchers all over the place.
People have tried to cheat for years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know what spider tack is, but I don't want to get bit by it. I tried to fool around with a spitball. I know when I was throwing, and it didn't do a heck of a lot. But I know guys had success with it. So back in the day, you tried that stuff. If you got caught, you got suspended or something, and that's the way it was. If you didn't get caught, and it worked. Hey, you got away with it. So it's illegal, but guys have been trying that kind of stuff. I remember them pulling out a lady's nail file out of the back pocket of Joe Niekro when they examined him. I said, what's this? He said, I use it for my nails to keep my nails nice. And I mean, Elston Howard used to scuff the ball and throw it back to Whitey Ford. Guys used to have belts that were, you know, where the belt buckle of the thing comes through, they would sharpen that and try to scrape the ball. So it's nothing new that pitchers and ball players have been trying that stuff. It's part of the lore. If you get caught, you get busted. If you don't get caught, it might work.
Steve, I think Pirates fans of a younger generation obviously, you know what you did to win the 71 World Series, are familiar with Clemente's story and Stargell and the core of that team. Over the course of the last 50 years, if you could speak to fans who weren't alive when you won that dramatic Game 7, who were some players from that team who you think, you know, deserve to still get the credit and still get a lot of attention today for their contributions to that club?
Well, you know, the obvious guys in that World Series, I pitched very well. And, of course, it was Clemente's time. Mm-hmm. For everybody to see what we'd been seeing here for 20 years. So I think it starts with Clemente as the centerpiece. He was magic to watch. For young fans, I would say, you know, he had the ability, first of all, to take a 10-year Major League veteran and to turn you into a 10-year-old kid. You didn't want to miss anything he did. I mean, he had a presence, even when he was kneeling in the on-deck circle. He had a presence. And so you start with him. You start with the guys that were in that, say that last game. Gene Kline's made a play in that last game when Clemente came in for a ball, misjudged it a little bit, and so it bounced beyond him. And Gene Kline's had come over from center field, made a one-hand catch of it, or that ball is still rolling, and Elrod Hendricks has at least a triple instead of a double. He wound up not scoring. So you look at the, I like to look at the secondary cast. Dave Cash, who in his first year taking over for Maz, did a heck of a job at second base. Jackie Hernandez, I would like young fans to know that Jackie Hernandez was a guy who our opposing manager Earl Weaver said you can't win the World Series with, and he makes the play that is the last out of the World Series. I mean, you look at those places. Sanguian, who was wonderful. I had wonderful rhythm with him. I mean, you can go around the field. Pagan plays third base and actually drives in the winning run with a hit-and-run play with Willie Stargell, of all people, who was as big as a beer truck at that point. As he approached third base, Frank Osiak, for the winning run, kept waving him in, and as he ran by, Willie told his story, as he ran by Frank Osiak, he says, "Really? Really?" Osiak is waving him in, and it's a surrender at home plate. It's not a slide to score the winning. Willie himself said it was a surrender. I mean, there's so much magic in that last game. I mean, to throw a hanging slider in a one-run game in the bottom of the ninth that ties it up, if that gets popped up instead of hit 400 feet. There was a play early in the World Series. Clemente hit a previous home run, and you can see it right at the end of the World Series film. Okay, he hits it over Frank Robinson's head, and that series was once billed between a battle between the best right fielders. And so the ball sails over Frank Robinson's head, and just before the camera goes away, as the ball clears his head and the wall, there's just a little subtle tip of the cap by Frank Robinson. That kind of stuff still gives me goosebumps. That is the old world professionalism that didn't have to be a grandstand gesture, just a tip of the cap from Frank Robinson to Clemente. That stuff is beautiful.
That is, and we give you a tip of the hat for joining us here today, Steve. I know your time in the Pirates has been well documented, but I think I speak on behalf of everyone, Andrew included, myself, yep, for thanking you for all the professionalism, all the things you did as a player, as a broadcaster, as an ambassador for sports, and specifically the Pirates and baseball in general. So thanks for that, and thank you for your time.
Well, thank you. You're very kind with that. And, you know, it's so easy to be an athlete in this city. All you have to do is reach out for a minute, and people, they'll reach you for 100 years. So, I feel lucky to have been here for a lot of years. It's been a great, great trip. Thank you so much.
Steve Blass. Know this, Pony? He was the author of 2 Hole-in-1 in the same round.
Oh, yeah. I read his book.
Yeah. How about that?
Yeah.
That's something that you never see, ever. And Steve did it. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, guys, again. Enjoyed the visit.
You've been listening to the Pomp and Pony Podcast, powered by Bowser Chevrolet. Join us each week for another Pomp and Pony Podcast.